Welcome to session 102 of the Bible in a Year commentary. If you started the series on the 1st of January, then today should be the 12th of April. Today we'll be looking at 2 Kings 4-7 and Psalm 102. But so far in 1st and 2nd Kings, we've read through Solomon's reign, the splitting of the kingdom and the era of kings and prophets. Solomon's reign began with eliminating his rivals. He then asked God for wisdom, which led to peace and prosperity in Israel. Solomon built the temple and his palace, but disobeyed God by accumulating wealth, horses and marrying foreign women, leading to idol worship. God told Solomon his kingdom would be divided after his death. Israel in the north under Jeroboam and Judah in the south under Rehoboam. Jeroboam led the northern tribes in worship to other gods. After Jeroboam, leaders like Nadab, Bashar, Elah, Zimri, Omri and Ahab followed in Israel, all doing evil. In Judah, Rehoboam also did evil, as did his son Abijam. Then came Asa, who returned the people to God but relied on Syria instead of God when attacked. He was replaced by his son Jehoshaphat. The story shifted to Elijah, a prophet who condemned Ahab for idolatry and predicted a drought. Elijah performed miracles, defeated Baal's prophets and fled from Jezebel. He met God, anointed new leaders and chose Elisha as his successor. Elijah condemned Ahab for seizing Naboth's vineyard and Ahab died in battle, succeeded by Ahaziah, then Jehoram. Yesterday we read as Elijah was taken to heaven and Elijah stepped up to fill his place. We saw Elijah performing many of the miracles Elijah had done. Then northern and southern kingdoms, Jehoram and Jehoshaphat, banded together to fight against Moab. While it looked like they were winning, the battle turned when the king of Moab sacrificed his own son. But let's jump in with today's reading, 2 Kings 4-7. We continue on with more of Elijah's ministry. We see a hugely compassionate side to Elijah through his miracles. Each miracle he performs in response to a need he sees in front of him. A widow comes to him in debt and worried that her children were going to be taken into slavery. He performs a miracle that allowed her to multiply the small amount of oil that she had so that she could sell it and pay off her debts. This parallels the miracle we saw Elijah perform for the widow of Zarephath in 1 Kings 17 verses 8-16. There, Elijah provides enough oil and flour to sustain the widow and her son. Here, Elijah provides enough oil for the widow to sell to others and make a profit. In his travels, he meets a wealthy woman who generously feeds him whenever he passes by and builds an extension on her house that he would have a room to stay. Wanting to bless her, he finds out that she has no children. She was likely barren. So he performs a miracle, opens up her womb and allows her to have a child. Later, the child dies and she comes to Elijah grieving. Seeing her sorrow, Elijah is once again moved by compassion. He comes back and raises the child from the dead. This parallels the miracles we saw Elijah perform raising the widow's son in 1 Kings 17 verses 17 to 24. There Elijah raised a young boy from the dead. Here Elijah first opens the womb of a barren woman so she could give birth, then raised that young boy when he died. Later, when he's with some fellow prophets, they make some stew to eat, but one prophet picks up some wild vegetables, not realising they're poisonous, and throws them into the stew. Realising that the stew is deadly, all the men refuse to eat it, so Elijah performs a miracle and cleans the stew of all death so that they can eat it again. Then another time, a man comes to bring Elijah an offering of some bread and grain, and Elijah tells him to give it to the prophets. The man points out that there is not enough bread to go around, and so Elijah performs a miracle so that not only is there enough, but there are some left over. Next up, a man called Naaman was the commander of the king of Syria's army, but he also had leprosy. In one of their raids against Israel, they picked up a little girl who became a servant to Naaman's wife. This little girl mentioned that if Naaman went to see Elijah, he would heal them. So Naaman is sent off, first off to the king of Israel and then to Elijah. But rather than meeting him face to face, Elijah sends a messenger to tell him to wash 7 times in the River Jordan. At first, Naaman was angry that Elijah wouldn't see him personally, but his servant encouraged him to do what Elijah said, and as soon as he did, he was healed. Going back to Elijah, he committed his life to the God of Israel. Naaman then asked Elijah for 2 mules loads of earth. At this time, the way people saw the gods was geographic. Each god was a god over a specific geographic domain, like Moab or Egypt or Syria. Yahweh, the God of the Bible, was the God of Israel. This was because he had disinherited the rest of the earth back in Genesis 11. That's not to say that Yahweh only had authority in Israel. The Exodus showed us he could enter the territory of other gods and defeat them on their own land. But it does mean that for the time, that Yahweh's presence was reserved for Israel. Because this land belonged to Yahweh, Naaman's hope was that if he could take some of the land with him, he could take Yahweh with him. That way, when he goes back to his land, where Rimmon was the geographic god, and his master offers sacrifices in the temple of Rimmon, Naaman would have the dirt of Yahweh to hold onto, and Yahweh would be with him. In these stories, we see not only is Elijah a prophet who is powerful, he's often moved by compassion for the widow, the hungry, and the foreigner. Unfortunately, the servant of Elijah, Gehazi, gets greedy and chases down Naaman, asking him for money and clothes. When Elijah finds out what he has done, he curses him with the very leprosy he had just healed Naaman from. This is followed by a story where Elisha causes a missing axe to float so it could be found. The king of Syria starts warring against Israel, but Elisha tells the king about the Syrians' plans before they even do them. On hearing this, the Syrians hunt down Elisha, who blinds them and leads them into the hands of the king of Israel. As a demonstration of power, the king then feeds them and sends them home unhurt. But then the king of Syria, Ben-Hadad, gathers his army and sieges Samaria, the capital of Israel. The city quickly runs out of food, and we read how the people resort to cannibalism, eating their own children to survive. It's awful. And you might think, how can God just let this happen? But the reality is, he gave them plenty of warning. We read back in Deuteronomy 28, the curses of disobedience. And the people of Israel warned that if they continually disobeyed and sinned against God, things would get worse and worse for them. Deuteronomy 28, verse 53 even predicts that they would be sieges so bad that people would end up eating their own children. But despite this, we see that God is in control. The king tries to arrest and kill Elijah, but Elijah refuses to come out. It tells the commander who comes to arrest him that by the next day there would be an abundance of food and that the commander would see it but not eat it. The very next day, some lepers offer themselves up to the Syrians, only to find that God had tricked them and chased them away. These lepers then alerted the town to all the food and wealth that the Syrians had left behind. The commander tried to manage the people coming in and out to get food, but they trampled him to death in their hurry, just as Elijah had predicted. Even in these dark times, even after all the disobedience of the people, God was still in control and God was still fighting for them. But that's 2 Kings 4-7. Now let's look at Psalm 102. This psalm is attributed to one afflicted when he is faint and pours out his complaint before the Lord. There's been much discussion about who this might be, but no concrete answers have emerged. It falls into the category of lament psalm. Here is a summary of the structure, but I would recommend checking out the written version of this commentary in the description to see the structure properly for yourself. We start off in verses 1 and 2, opening request. Verses 3 to 11, the complaint. Verses 12 to 17, declaration of trust. Verses 18 to 22, the declaration of trust for future generations. And then verses 23 to 28, the final complaint, request and declaration of trust. The psalmist opens with a request for God to listen. They ask that God hear them and show up. They then get to the complaint. The psalmist feels like they are wasting away. Their days are like smoke, easily blown away. Their bones crumbling and turning to ash like they've been burnt in a furnace. Their heart is like grass that has been cut and withered away. The psalmist is weak, wasting away and lonely. They are surrounded by enemies who curse and taunt them. And all of this is because of God's indignation and anger. To the psalmist, it feels like God is the one punishing them. And then the psalmist encourages themselves with some truth about God. He is enthroned forever as king. There will come a time again when God will have pity on Jerusalem and restore her. Once again, nations will fear the Lord's name and Jerusalem will be the pinnacle of his glory because he hears the prayers of those in need. The psalmist then looks forward to future generations. They want them to know that the Lord looks down from heaven and sees those who are captive and hurting and sets them free. There will come a time when all people and kingdoms will come together to worship the Lord. Finally, the psalmist turns back to their own situation. God has broken their strength and shortened their days. They ask God to lengthen their life, for God is eternal. He created the heavens and the earth. Both of those will one day perish, but God will remain, for God has no end. Because of this, those who are loyal to God can be confident he will always be there for them.